Now, please help me welcome Ryan R., who will introduce our speaker.
Should have brought you the mic, I know.
Yeah, fuck you too. I love you too. I'm Ryan, I'm an addict. I've thought about this a little bit this afternoon before he told me I was going to do it, because I figured I might, you know. And I first met Mr. Smith in mid-November of 1986, and I had about 6 weeks clean, and he had 18 months clean. And he was a strange bird, and he still is a strange bird. And I didn't pay him much attention because he was 18 years old, you know, and I was 38. And I figured, what the hell could he know about any damn thing? And I've got 38 years of my life invested in this guy, and he has taught me a lot over that time about how much I don't know that I thought I did know. And that's a humbling experience. And it's good to be humbled, you know, and I didn't think it was. And I'm not saying humiliated, I'm saying humbled. And that's what you call paying for your education in a way that's not bad. And he had some strange mannerisms and quirks, and he still does, you know, but he's fortunate in that, you know, he's had a bunch of different careers over his course of time. You know, he's been, he repossessed children from the state of Alabama at one point in time, and he didn't really like kids, or he didn't at the time. I think he kind of does now, but he's been an attorney. He's in a counselor now, and I find that very bizarre. But he's been married and divorced 6 times. I don't know if he's going to tell you about that or not. But he must really like being married, or not. I don't know. Am I telling his story? I guess I kind of am. But me and Terry kind of fucked with him about telling his Mr. Humility story, but maybe he'll tell that and maybe he won't. But I'm blessed to have him in my life, I'll tell you that. And if you don't know that, I want you to know that. And I don't know if he'll talk about that or not. But without further ado, I give you my good friend, Damon Quinn Smith, Esquire.
I'm Damon. I'm an addict. Well, you know, supposed to talk about what happened, what it's like now. So, you know, that's what I'll try to do. Oh, and thank you for the committee for getting me a free room and stuff. That was great. You know, all that stuff. Well, you know, mostly I was born, you know, to a, you know, kind of a middle-class kind of family. My dad, he was the FBI agent. Mom was a Tupperware salesman. We just lived in this little neighborhood, and I was kind of a socially awkward kid. My parents, they did the best they could with what they had to work with, but they didn't know how to live very well themselves, so they didn't have a lot to pass on. So I was kind of there winging it. And I didn't do a good job of it. I found that when I was in, you know, a young boy in school, I was not popular. Like, you know, the other kids didn't jive with me for whatever reason. They just weren't into me, even though I was, you know, fabulous. But you know, they just weren't. So I had this low self-esteem, and I'd also kind of feel like I was, you know, better than some of them, really, I guess. So it's kind of that kind of thing. So I was a loner. And then one day, probably about, you know, about 11 or 12, I started, you know, getting drunk with my family at the dance in Oklahoma, because all my family was from Oklahoma. And Uncle Pete, he would give me a little bit of whiskey. And I remember that feeling, and that was good, but I wasn't that much into it. But when I really got to going was, I don't know, probably about fifth, sixth grade, somewhere around there, I found that, you know, these other kids in school, some of them would sell me marijuana if I would buy it from them. And I went out into the woods and I tried to learn to smoke it. So that's what I did. And I didn't get much out of it, but I kept practicing. And eventually I got better at it. And then I found out that, you know, if you did drugs, that you could fit in with the crowd of the low self-esteem, which was the other kids using drugs, you know. So they accepted me completely. All you had to do is have drugs or some money and some time, and you fit in that group. So I hung out with them, and, you know, that was fine until after a while. It wasn't going so well. And I hit about, I'd say about 14. And I got arrested for, I was selling marijuana at the skate center. And that was frowned on because the other little children were there. I was a little child too. And I found that that was really popular. If I could sell drugs, I would be popular. So I did that. And the police officer there, for some reason, he didn't like my father. I think he had some kind of beef against him personally, but he arrested me and stuff, and they took me in. And Dad, him being an FBI agent, he was kind of embarrassed that I was there, but they kind of cut me loose, not as any, you know, fear of him. It's more of a being nice to each other, cops being kind of nice to each other. So they did that a couple of times, and Dad was pretty disappointed. But then they got divorced, and, you know, I could run completely wild. And I hit about 14. I was on probation, and they made me come to these meetings, NA meetings, and get a little card signed, my juvenile probation officer. And I was going, and I was dating this gal at the time that also went to the meetings. Her name was Kathy. She's dead now. But, you know, she was like 10 years older than me. She was like a junkie. And so I was 14, and I brought her to my junior prom. And she was high as a kite. But we had a good time, and you know, I hung out with her until one day I woke up, and the sheriff's deputy, they were like dragging me out of my bed at Mom's house. And that was because Mom had decided I needed to go to treatment. So they took me to treatment, to Charter Retreat. I was probably, I don't know, maybe almost 15 by this time, probably. I can't remember. It's so long ago. I'm old now. But I was there, and people were, you know, they tried to teach you some stuff. But back then, there was no real treatment center for a juvenile. And so I was there on the nut house side. So I was there like 4 months, but they would let us go to one meeting a week on the adult side, the A&D, the people that wanted to. And they gave me a full set of books, you know, NA, the other fellowship, everything. And so I read those books while I was there because I had nothing better to do. And I did see me on all those pages, you know, but I wasn't ready then because I ran away after I got out of there, you know, and I went back home with Mom. I ran away from home. And what I did, see, I'd been selling, you know, the drugs and all, and I bought a car without her permission or her knowledge when I was, I don't know, 14, 15, and I had some other guy sign for it, and I had it, and I stole the car back from her after I was back from retreat, and went to New Jersey, and they had divorced. And so I went up to New Jersey, and I knocked on my dad's door and said, "Hey, I've come to live with you," you know, and he was just thrilled. So, you know, I stayed there for a while, and this is my first time I actually tried to do something different, because on my way up there, I decided I was not going to take any more drugs. I was going to change my life. Geographical cure. That's basically what I was doing. So I went up there, and that lasted, I don't know, 3 or 4 months. And then I started hanging around all the other kids that got high. And so eventually I just got high. And it just went down from there, and I ended up moving back to Florence, Alabama, where I'm, you know, from. And so I was going to high school, and I was hanging out, and I was trying to make the best of it, I guess. And then I started to, I don't know, started to become really depressed, like saw no meaning in life. And, you know, this was about, I was, you know, probably 17, right about this time, and I was just becoming more and more depressed. I was getting to where I wouldn't leave my house. I didn't want to go outside. I didn't want to hang out with my friends anymore. I looked at all my friends, and I was like, this is where my life is going. And my friends, they were all older than me, and I could look at their lives and see that it was crap. You know, it was just going to go bad. They were starting to get arrested, some of them starting to die, and bad things were happening to them right and left. And, you know, I could see that it was the drugs, and they were going down this path, and there was absolutely no reason that my path would be any different than their path. Because, you know, I just, for some reason, at that young age, recognized that. I didn't think that was a big deal now, like back then, but now I see it as a big deal, because experience has taught me that not many young people really get clean and stay clean. You know, so one day, I wasn't on probation, and I wasn't under request from my parents or anything like that. Somehow I showed up to an NA meeting, because I think I just didn't want to, you know, die, because I was kind of going to a bad place mentally. So I was like, I'm going to give that a try. And it was not because of any great, you know, belief that they would do better, but I remembered that those people in those meetings were nice to me, and they were kind to me, and they would invite me to Shoney's after the meeting, even though I was very irritating juvenile that was a compulsive liar that constantly sought attention. You know the type, you know. Y'all, many of you are the type, I'm sure. But anyway, I did all that, but they would kept inviting me anyway, so I remembered that. I remembered that kindness more than anything else, and that they were happy, and I related to them and saw that they had a happy life, and they seemed to have came from the place that I'd come from. So I showed up, and this was right around, you know, April 10th, 85. So that's when I got clean, and that was, you know, 40 years ago. So I am old. I'm an old, old man, you know. I will be 60 before you know it, you know. And I'm single, and, you know, that's the way it is. And that's fine. Okay, so I got clean, and I went, okay, well, what do I do now? You know, what is this whole recovery thing? Now, they said work the steps. That's what they said, work the steps. So I took them at their word, but they were all liars, really. Because they had not written a fourth step, you know. I was the one that did it with them, and they had not done one, but we winged it through it, and that was fine. But now it's only years later that I look back, and after hearing them talk, that, you know, they weren't really doing that back then. It just wasn't happening. But my dumb ass, I was like, I'm just following the directions. It says it in the book. So I followed what the book said to do, and, you know, it works. You know, just the regular old book, you know. And I would show up. I would go to meetings every day. And I followed the directions and I wrote a fourth step, so I needed a sponsor to share it to, so I asked somebody to be my sponsor. His name was Andy. He's still alive, but, you know, he was my sponsor for a long time, you know. And then I got Ryan, you know. He was at meetings, and he did really good until there were some social problems, and he kind of dropped off as requested by his family members, I think. We won't go into that, but you can imagine, you know, what it was. So, you know, it's one of the things. But I digress. Never mind. Okay, but anyway, we worked on the steps, me and Andy, and I went over my fourth step with him, did the fifth step. You know, I shared everything in it. And now, doing the fourth step, I did not think that I would do that. When I wrote the fourth step, I wrote it like, well, I'm going to write everything down, and some of this I'm just not going to share, you know, because I'm just not willing to. But I'm going to be open-minded and write it all down. So I did, and I ended up sharing all the stuff with them, and it helped me. And it's been that way with each of the steps. I'll work a step. Now, this is, don't get me wrong, do I work steps all the time? No, no. And that's, I think, the important message that I can give you is that if you're new in the program, work the steps as quickly as you can, because this is what's going to happen. And I see it over and over, happens to me, happens to pretty much everybody. You start to become happy. Your life gets better. And you know what you're going to do? You're going to be lazy and you're going to quit working those steps. So work them that first 5 years. Work the heck out of them. You know, because you're going to get bored and you're going to be unwilling to do the work after a while because you're happy and you'll get complacent and go, okay, this is fine. So, you know, I did that. I showed up. I did the steps with Andy. You know, did all the way through to the, you know, men's list, the whole thing, within a year, I'd say, and got that done. So what happened? Well, things got better. You know, I started wanting to be alive and happy and stuff like that. And then, of course, you know, I started to want to find me a girlfriend. So I did that, you know. I found this gal, you know, she was, you know, at least an hour and a half out of treatment. I don't know. She was not actually shaken, but, you know, and she was like 10 years older than me. She was this old chick. She dead, too. Y'all die a lot. It's just the way it is. But she was, her name was Susan. She was my first wife. And I got married to her because I knocked her up. She was like, I don't know, a liar. You know, she'd say, I have endometriosis and I can't get pregnant, blah, blah, blah. You don't got to do that. So I believed her. And, you know, my son's name is Luke. You know, he's 35. And so that lasted about a year. And my buddy, Robbie, he went to my wedding. You know, he's my best man. And he said, oh, this will be okay, Damon. It'll only last a year or so. It'll be fine. Don't worry about it. Because, you know, he knew I didn't like her, you know. So we had a kid. And I thought, well, you know, no family should be without a marriage. You know, that kind of thing. Marriage is something that no family should be without. That's what I thought. Even though all my friends would say, Damon, you should run. You don't have to do that. That's not a good idea. Blah, blah, blah. You know, so, but I didn't listen to any of that. So I got married and I went to college because, well, I mean, you got to go to college if your family will pay for it. Because, you know, I figured out I could work and I had a working experience. I worked at McDonald's briefly. And I found that that was the hardest job in my entire life. Looking back, I see no difference. That was the hardest job I ever had in my life. So I worked there for a little while until I couldn't stand it no more. And I realized that my family would send me to college and give me a check as long as I made a C average or better. So I went for a long time. And just like any other, you know, new, young, recovering person, what should I major in? Well, I should major in social work because I want to be a therapist, a counselor, you know, work with the drug addicts, blah, blah, blah. You know, because we all think this is a great idea. It was not a great idea for me. I did that for a little while. I worked at DHR like Ryan was talking about. I repossessed children. You know, that was my job, was to be a child abuse investigator. I'd go from ghetto to ghetto, knock on their door and say, hey, we got this report, you know. Have you been doing these bad things to, you know, little Johnny or little Janie? And, you know, sometimes I'd go back to the office, and my supervisor, she was like, Damon, you are different than the new social workers. I go, well, what do you mean? I remember what she told me. She said, it's like the new social workers, they all want to pull the children immediately from the household because they think it's just horrible. And you're like, do you want me to move the sack of potatoes? Send somebody to check on the sack of potatoes? Do you want me to get somebody involved with the sack of potatoes? You don't care at all. You know, you're doing the job, but you don't, you know, there's nothing there. So I couldn't disagree, you know, that I did have a certain problem with empathy. You know, at that time, I was kind of flat. I come from kind of flat people. Dad's pretty flat. Grandpa was pretty flat. I'd say they're pretty flat. So it's an effort for me to have those things, you know. So I have to work on it. It doesn't come natural. Some people are bleeding heart crybabies. Well, I'm not one of those. I'm the opposite of that. So anyway, I did that for a while. I worked as a counselor. I worked at some of y'all may recognize this place. It was Whitfield, Mississippi, at Whitfield Hospital. I worked there for a while, and I got my master's in social work at Southern Miss. Ooh, you know, it's a good school. We had a good time. I went there because I figured out that, well, my family would send me the check if I went to school, so I went a long time. So, you know, I just kept doing that because, you know, why not? Because school is a lot of fun. So I went to, you know, Hattiesburg to school, and I was in this wonderful social work master's program. I had such a good time there because, you know, there was about 30 women in this program, and there was about 5 men. 3 of them were gay. And so by default, even though I had a poor personality, it was just a great time for me because I was there, you know. So I had a good time doing that, you know. And during that time, you know, I was visiting my child that I had with my first wife. And, you know, I didn't really like that relationship or the whole thing. It just made me bitter. And I don't know how else to put it, you know. So while I was in Hattiesburg, I got fixed. You know, you can get them vasectomy things. So I was like, you know, I'm going to get fixed. And all the women there were like, Damon, that's a terrible mistake because you're too young. And the doctor didn't really want to do it, but I did it anyway because I was like, I'm really jaded at this point. So that's what it did. And so that's been my life, you know. Whether that was the best decision or not, as I get older, I look back and I'm like, I don't know, you know, maybe I would have been better. But on the other hand, at the time, I was like, I don't want to have 3 or 4 kids with 3 or 4 different women that I don't have relationships with and just pay child support. Because I was like, this is the road I'm going down. Just like those drug addicts when I was a teenager, I could see the road and I didn't want to go down that road. Of course, I could have done something else, I suppose, but I guess I wasn't willing to at the time. So anyway, I digress. I went to school, and I finished up school, and I was a social worker and did that, and I was rocking along. I was doing just fine, and then I went to an NA meeting at like a church, you know, we had a thing, and there was this pretty, pretty little newcomer girl, and she was talking to this lady, and I was talking to my friend, and I was like, who is that? And he was like, well, that's Emily. And I go, well, who's that stone? That's her mom. And I was like, my little brain was like, she's pretty. And in 20 years, her mom is going to be pretty. So I was like, I think I'm going to marry her. And that's what I thought, you know. And I'd never spoken not one word to this woman. So, you know, there's something wrong with my picker. You know, I some kind of disconnect. So anyway, I got married to her, and that did not last, shockingly. It did not last long because, you know, she didn't really care for me that much. She was cute and, you know, it was okay. But really, I kind of liked her mama better. But because we related to a lot of things. But anyway, we had a good time until we didn't. And then she started dating somebody else and got rid of me. So that was fine. That was my second wife. And that's when I realized what I've been doing. And I've done this a lot throughout life. And I don't advise it. But this is what I do. This is relationships for me in a nutshell. Okay, I'm standing at a bus stop. Okay, and I'm waiting on a bus to come by. Because I don't have a bus. I'm not on a bus. So I'm going to get on the next bus that looks reasonably well and ride that bus until it crashes. And what I should be doing is I should look at the bus and go, is this a well-maintained bus? Is this a mechanically sound bus? Will this bus get me to where I want to go? Is this bus even going in the direction that I want to go? You know, are there any redeeming things about this bus? Is this bus filled with gangsters and criminals on the inside that I can't see because the windows are blacked out? No, I'm just going to get on the bus and I'm going wherever it's going. And I've done that many times in life, and sometimes I was lucky and I got a good bus. And, you know, kind of screwed it up. And sometimes I was unlucky and I got a bad bus and it was really painful. But really what I need to learn is to look at red flags. Because there's red flags. You know, if I will observe relationships, I will see the truth. And people will tell you the truth by their actions. They will show who they are. And then the logical thing is for me to make selections based on that information before jumping all the way in. But that's not historically what I've done. And that's not what a lot of people do, I observe. And, you know, they'll talk about, you know, a 13th step or this or that. But I've never believed any of that crap. You know, I just haven't. I think that we have 12 steps and that people have to immediately make good decisions in their life and, you know, live with them. So I have to make good decisions. I have to learn from them. You know, they talk about, oh, we shouldn't make major decisions in the first year, stuff like that. But life is not like that. You got to make major decisions all the way along. And I have to make them, you know. And the sooner I learn to make good decisions, the happier I'm going to be. Now, I don't advise somebody just jumping out there a lot of times because when I'm new, I don't have much ability to make good decisions. They're just terrible. My decisions are awful. They're based on low self-esteem, incomplete knowledge, a lot of things. So I'm going to get what I get, but I'm going to learn things, and that's fine. But the point is that no matter how bad that relationship goes, I don't have to get high. I can come back to meetings, sit my butt in the chair right across from that person I was previously sleeping with, painful though that may be, and stay clean. And in 6 months or so, it'll be better. But I have to stay there. So if I can't stay there and do exactly that, I ain't got no business messing with that because it's going to kill me. Because I have to be able to come here. It's really important that I come here, you know. people will think sometimes that it gets, you know, better and I don't need to come here. Well, I obviously need to come here. You know, often I have felt like I'm standing on a pyramid of dead people because I have been here so long that I have seen that this disease is, people will think it's like the flu, but it's not. It's more like lung cancer. It's probably going to kill you. You know, it's a very, very serious disease and it wipes out the majority of us. And any chance I have to work a step or get a sponsor or do that one extra thing to improve my odds of making it another day, it's a good thing to do. It's a good investment in my time because I need to stay here. I need to make it because without NA, I'm left on my own. And I have done that. I have been married to ladies that weren't from here, you know, earth women, you might say, and I quit coming here for years at a time. I've done that for, you know, where I just didn't come for about 4 or 5 years, you know, and I didn't get high because I knew what would happen if I did, but I also decreased in my happiness. I became despondent and, you know, unsatisfied and depressed, and because I wasn't working these steps and I wasn't around y'all's people, and it seems like if I'm gone for a while, I'll forget this stuff. I'll quit, you know, practicing it. I won't pray. I'll just stop doing the things that I know to do, and then I'll suffer. But I know from being around so long is that if I'm miserable. And if I come to a meeting and I sit my butt in the chair for 90 days, it will cure whatever is happening in my life. I will get better and I will get through it. And I will come out on the other side and I will stay clean another year. And a lot of people, I don't think, do that. I think they will drop out. They will quit coming. They will quit doing the things they know they got to do because they don't know they got to do it to survive. They'll think they cannot do it, and then they'll back themselves into a corner, and they won't stay clean. And they'll wake up 10 years later and go, 10 years gone, and my life is terrible, and I need to go back there. But you don't have to do that. You can just go sit in the chair, and it'll be all right. Let's see. I don't know.
John.
Hmm. Oh, John! Ryan always wants me to tell you about John. Oh, yeah. Okay. John Forrest Parker. I used to get high with him all the time in 8th grade and 9th grade and, you know, right around there. And the odd story is, okay, oh, I forgot to tell you this. After I got out of grad school, I realized you couldn't make a lot of money as a social worker back then, so I decided that, you know, I'd do something else because I was standing there and there was this conversation with these people and they were talking about Birmingham School of Law and that all you needed to get in there was a check and a degree from any place with any GPA. I didn't believe them, but I signed up and they were correct. They let me in. They sent me the letter saying, bring your check, come on down, fall semester. So I went down and, you know, I went to law school at Birmingham School of Law at night. And during the day, I repossessed children at DHR. So that was, you know, my whole job. And I did that for like 3 years and, you know, got the degree and I passed the bar. I passed the bar because I was so afraid that my best would not be good enough because at that school, 60% of the people failed the bar. So I would look around and I would go, who's the dumbass in this class? And I'd go, is it me? You know, because I was like, ew, you know, these do not look like dumb people, you know. So I studied super hard for a year, took the home study course, sat and did, you know, little 3x5 cards, thousands of them, and looked at them all day, 8 hours a day, for a year. And I passed that sucker. So anyway, I digress. I was a new lawyer interning with this other lawyer who did death penalty appeals. That was mostly what he did. So I show up one day and we go to court, and there's John Parker, my buddy. Okay, and he's there on a death penalty appeal. And I'm sitting there in my little suit, and we shake hands, and he goes, "I read about you in the paper." There was a little article on me in the paper when I was doing, you know, going around giving talks when I was a teenager, because that was the thing to do. So he was talking to me, and he sat down, and I sat down with my lawyer that I was, you know, working for, and went over this case of him. You know, they were trying to get the knife thrown out as evidence on appeal. It didn't work. But, you know, we were just sitting there, and it was so ironic that me and him would get high together. He came to NA several times, but he kept going on the path he was on. He was not an insane psychopath when I knew him. He was just a regular kid. So he was not. So he became something different, because one day him, two other fellas, agreed that this Church of Christ preacher would pay them, I think it was $1,100 split three ways, to go and murder his wife and not tell anybody about it. But they did not do a very good job with that, because they needed to get, you know, high before they did it. So he went over there and they stabbed the lady to death, and they, you know, threw her out somewhere. And she was very dead, and he definitely did it. But he was not a nut then. He just became, you know, emotionally flat, really, really flat, to where he could do that kind of behavior. And then, you know, it was weird, because I was a lawyer and I followed him along the years, and I sent a letter about, you know, how he was, but the governor ignored it, you know, and they, you know, executed him, I don't know, 10 years or so ago. And so he's quite dead. And I've been a lawyer for 28 years now. And I'm mostly retired from that, but it makes money, so I have another lawyer and a couple paralegals, and they do the work, and I do accounting. But what I'm doing nowadays is I'm a therapist at this behavioral health place, so I listen to people and their stories for about 50 minutes, about six times a day, and they are just screwed. People are, man. They are just a mess. And I get such gratitude, because I'll listen to them talk, and it's like the people that in this society apparently that are not drug addicts, they become anxious, crazy people. You know, they become, anxiety rules their life. They're fearful of things that don't exist about, you know, about their life. Just nonsense, like, I don't want to drive across this bridge because I'm afraid it'll fall down. I don't want to go out of my house because I'm afraid people will watch me chew at a restaurant. So, the strangest things you'd ever see. But, you know, they do that all the time. So I chat with them and I listen to them talk. And then the rest of the time I'll answer texts from my paralegals. And so I do that. And also, I got married a whole bunch more times. One of them in NA, she was a gal. She was like 15 years younger than me. She was a stripper. You really shouldn't marry a stripper if you're not willing to really, you know, have a lot of issues, you know. Not to offend any former strippers out there, of which I'm sure there's, you know, 5 or 10, I don't know. But, you know, they have lots of issues with men because, you know, we're bad. And at the strip joint, I'm sure we're even worse. So you had that. And I married a Japanese lady once. I was married to her for 8 years. I can highly recommend that. I think that if you know, if you have the option, you really should marry a Japanese chick if you get because they're very nice. But they're very not like American women. They're like, they won't tell you what they think or feel, ever. They won't tell you, but you must figure it out through observation. And you know what? One thing that American guy is bad at? Observation. It's really a problem. So, you know, she started to dislike me after a while. And, you know, we couldn't have no kids, so, you know, she was ready for that. But, you know, didn't work out. let's see, that was 1, 2, 3. Oh, and I married a gym freak. Oh, she was so pretty. But she was really angry all the time. And really, I think looking back, it was because she was starving. You know? I mean, I've tried to diet myself at times, and that's rough. You know, if you just eat protein and some fiber and that's it, you know, it'll piss you off, you know. I can't deny that. You know, that was good, so... And, you know, sometimes things don't work out, but don't get high is what I'm saying, you know, no matter what. Now, I'm sure it'd be great if I could tell you about my fabulous and smooth and effective life, but that just wasn't the life I lived, you know. It's just wasn't. I'd be lying, you know. It's been kind of a train wreck in some ways, you know, but... I don't regret it. I mean, it's been a good life. It's been a hell of a ride. It's been fascinating. I mean, I've gotten to go to, I don't know, 35 countries. I've traveled all over the world and gone to meetings everywhere. And they are everywhere. Muslim countries, Hindu countries. They were everywhere. And they're dedicated. You know, I'll go to any country and I show up. Those people are nice to me. They take care of me. They're very good to me consistently in any country in the world. You know, they just are. So we're a good bunch of people. We're different. I mean, I won't say that it's been normal to grow up the way I grew up. But it's your fault. Just to let you know, because my parents didn't teach me a lot. So everything that I am as a human being, y'all molded me into. Because it's you as a group that created me. And there is no doubt about that. So I am just the odd hodgepodge of y'all. And but I think you ultimately as a group did a pretty good job, you know, with what you had to work with. So... Oh, wait, I'm way over, so I'll shut up. Love y'all.